I hope you've enjoyed listening to some of our favourite episodes over Christmas and New Year, along with updates. Today, we're talking about the US presidential race and asking how the American media will cope with Donald Trump this time round. And Carol Anderson asks about the people who could be denied the right to vote in that election. I think it's fair to say that in 2016, pretty much every newsroom in America was caught by surprise when President Trump won the election.
What a night!
And a complete earthquake. This was an earthquake unlike any earthquake I've really seen since Ronald Reagan in 1980. It just came out of nowhere.
Immediately afterwards, you spoke to a whole variety of reporters and editors about what had happened. What was the mood then?
Yeah, well, it went way beyond surprise into the zone of deep shock. And I go even further than that. I think there was actual trauma in newsrooms across America. That led to some very kind of existential questions about how could they have missed the story, like as in such a gargantuan way? How could they have got it so wrong?
4 years on, Ed Pilkington, chief reporter at Guardian US, has returned to newsrooms across America ahead of a momentous year of political reporting. Working with the Columbia Journalism Review, Ed and his colleagues have spoken to 30 leading editors, reporters, and TV executives about one of the greatest challenges the American media has ever faced: covering Donald Trump. The president is already in campaign mode, ready and waiting for whichever Democratic Party candidate wins the nomination. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, covering the 2020 presidential election. We're now more than 3 years on. It's 2020. The next election is in sight. A lot has changed. When you went back to see reporters and editors, what was the mood like now?
I think once the trauma had set in 2016, there was a lot of soul searching, and a fairly profound question was being asked, which was there any degree in which the media itself had contributed to the victory of Donald Trump? And that has led to a lot of deep thinking about, could the same happen again? Could the media, by making mistakes of balance, of proportion, of emphasis, give Donald Trump his leg up into re-election and 4 more years in the White House? Now, of course, the media here is clear that its job is not to tell voters who to put into office. And at this stage, I would say, as we go into the primaries, the prevailing mood is anxiety.
And when you say, was there something that news organizations did that actually helped Donald Trump, is that kind of the way that he was covered? Was that jumping on every twist and turn? Was that kind of giving him perhaps a bigger platform than other candidates may have got?
Yes, I think the overwhelming thing was that he got kind of blanket coverage in a way that, first off, his rivals in the Republican primary season did not get, and then Hillary Clinton did not enjoy either when it came to the general election. His every cough and spittle was covered in deep detail. I mean, there were very good journalistic reasons for covering this stuff, because there'd never been a candidate like he was, and so you couldn't ignore it. But the outcome, which people hadn't anticipated, was that he had a vast amount of free media that was way out of kilter with any of his rivals, and he turned out to be a master at using that.
His celebrity has driven media coverage, which in turn has boosted his celebrity. The result? The New York Times found Trump has received nearly $2 billion of free media attention during the campaign.
He dictated the media agenda. He dictated the 24/7 news coverage. And I think people agree, they can't come to agree, that in no small part that gave him a help into winning the election.
And in terms of people not really seeing what was coming, there was a sense afterwards that perhaps journalists themselves didn't understand it because they didn't have much in common with those voters. I mean, one charge that's often levelled at us, at journalists here and in the US, is that we're somehow elite. or perhaps that we don't reflect the demographics of the people and places we cover. Maybe the reason that people in America missed the rise of Donald Trump in 2016, and perhaps the reason that people here didn't truly believe that Brexit was going to happen, was because we weren't living that story. I mean, there's some really stark statistics here from the Pew Research Center. 1 in 5 newsroom employees live in New York, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. Do people still think that this is a problem?
Absolutely. It's a huge issue. Bear in mind what an extraordinarily vast and diverse country America is. More than 300 million people, extraordinary diversity in ethnicity, in culture, and we're seeing increasing polarization of culture too between the coasts and the heartlands. And so, you know, Trump, again, he turned out to be a master at exploiting that. And he talked about the forgotten voters.
The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
And to a large degree, those voters were forgotten.
But the lack of representation in newsrooms isn't just about geography. Another statistic for you, 60% of employees are male. What does that gender imbalance mean?
One of those massive, deep, soul-searching questions that came out of 2016 was, had there been a disparity in the way that Trump and Hillary Clinton were covered?
Clinton's primary grievance with the coverage was the fixation on one story, that during her time as U.S. Secretary of State, she used her family's private email server for official...
You know, Hillary Clinton, there was a lot of emphasis put into covering her private emails, for instance, and arguably nothing like as proportionately as much put into Trump and allegations of sexual assault. And that's something that, as we go into 2020, again, I think newsrooms have done something to try and address issues of disparity within gender and their staff. But 4 years is relatively short time to sort of make major inroads in that. And as we go into 2020, that question is a very real one. It's something that Margaret Sullivan, who I think is one of the most insightful media commentators in America today, of the Washington Post, that's something that she's worrying a great deal about as we go into the primaries.
I think there's still some sexism in the coverage of the women candidates. And while that has improved a whole lot since Hillary Clinton ran, it's still not great.
Who do you see that against? Elizabeth Warren in particular?
Yes, and I think particularly Elizabeth Warren, but not solely. I mean, the sort of disappearance of Kamala Harris from the conversation, I think, has some of that wrapped into it. And I think the constant discussions of whether Elizabeth Warren is likable enough to be elected reflects a kind of inherent sexism that we haven't really dealt with. I mean, there's this research that says women who are seen as ambitious, you know, have a strike against them. Well, if you're running for president, guess what? You're ambitious.
It's so depressing that we even have to have these conversations about female candidates. And then there's another issue. Around 60% of Americans are white, but 75% of staff in newsrooms are. Tell me about race.
Well, race is obviously another massive fault line in American society and in American electoral politics. The issue of African-American voters is going to be huge in 2020 this year. And in fact, it was probably crucial in 2016. The fact the African-American vote turned out was slightly soft for Hillary Clinton in 2016 was an important factor in her loss to Donald Trump that year.
Non-white voters did not vote for Hillary Clinton in as big a margins as they had voted for Barack Obama.
And that issue of low turnout is even greater with the Latino community in America, which is the fastest growing population in this country. In 2016, turnout was under 50% of eligible Latino voters. So it's a real problem. It happens every cycle. And it's something that's of great concern to Jorge Ramos.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are dismal. And let me start with the political...
Now, Jorge Ramos is one of the best-known Latino journalists in America. He's a superstar among Spanish-speaking Americans. He's the main news anchor of Univision, which is the dominant Spanish-language TV channel in this country. And he's been here for 20, 30 years, and he's watched every cycle the Latino vote fail to sort of carry the punch that statistically it should have by now. And he wonders a great deal about to what extent is that because the Latinos are themselves underrepresented in newsrooms across the country.
We don't have enough reporters in newsrooms. We don't have enough Latinos on the air. So when President Trump said in 2015, June 2015, Mexican immigrants are criminals and rapists.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
That's a racist statement. But many people were not comfortable calling him out on that.
Is that changing this time?
It's interesting that Jorge Ramos was, I think, the most optimistic of everyone we spoke to. And we spoke to about 15 people. And with our partners, the Columbia Journalism Review, we got up to about 30 different senior people. And of all those, Jorge Ramos was the most optimistic, which I find in itself interesting.
I see changes. The first presidential debate among Democratic candidates was organized by NBC and by Telemundo. And by just the fact of having José Díaz-Balart as one of the moderators, Spanish was being spoken in that debate.
Congresista O'Rourke, ¿qué haría usted en el primer día, si usted es presidente, sobre esta realidad que está ocurriendo? What would you do, Congressman, day one at the White House?
Vamos a tratar cada persona.
Immigration was addressed and Hispanic issues were talked about. So in other words, the fact just having a different voice and having a Latino presence can change the whole conversation. And this is something that I'm seeing now that I did not see in 2016.
And Jorge Ramos was the journalist kicked out of a press conference by Donald Trump. Why did that happen? And does he worry it could happen again?
Yes, it's interesting. Jorge became a story in himself in 2016 when he was forcibly ejected from a press conference that Trump gave.
Just when you think Donald Trump can't come up with a fresh way to keep himself in the headlines, he's done it again. Just hours ago, a remarkable confrontation on camera with perhaps America's best-known Latino anchorman, our colleague from Univision and Fusion, Jorge Ramos.
Because he stood up and insisted on asking a question about Trump's racist language in his immigration policy.
Okay, who's next? Yeah, please. Excuse me, sit down. You weren't called. Sit down. Sit down. Sit down. Go ahead. No, you don't. You haven't been called. Go back to Univision.
And that was in itself a huge story in 2016. And so I kind of expected 3 years later, 3.5 years later, that he would have had a very critical take on how things are going. But in 2016, he was one of the very few who were literally standing up to Trump. He stood up and insisted on asking this question that got him thrown out.
I have the right to ask a question.
Very few people came to his support.
In 2015, only two reporters in the room, Tom Yama from ABC and Casey Hunt from MSNBC, they were the only ones who protested and told Mr. Trump, you cannot do that to an American reporter. I would bet that today it would be a different story, that more reporters would protest if another correspondent is ejected from a press conference by the president.
He thinks now things have moved on, that there are many more top journalists in the country standing up, you know, calling a spade, and he feels quite heartened by the robustness of media coverage of the Trump era.
I mean, it's interesting to hear his positivity, especially given what happened to him. Was everyone you spoke to as optimistic?
Oh, no, absolutely not. No, I think, you know, the prevailing mood, as we were discussing at the beginning, is one of anxiety, of apprehension. And there's another whole strain of anxiety about going into 2020, and that is that some observers, and I'm thinking of Samita Mukhopadhyay, who is a senior editor at Teen Vogue, she talked to us about, in her impression, post-2016, things didn't get better, they actually got worse.
I actually think one of the things that happened after 2016 is people felt that they needed less diverse newsrooms because they were concerned that they had gone, quote, too far left, or they were incorporating these kind of identity politics too much, and that was alienating this kind of white base that was all riled up for Trump, right?
Well, do you think the sort of the forgotten voter that Trump talked about?
Yes.
The media overcompensated for that and tried to talk to the forgotten voter, whoever that person was.
Absolutely. I think absolutely. I think that was done in a way that people didn't say it explicitly.
That newsrooms took on board and kind of imbibed Trump's talk about the forgotten voter, which is a euphemism for white working class, usually male voters, and actually said to themselves, we should be doing less diversity. We should be talking more about white working class male issues and less about identity politics, which is obviously very big in the Democratic side of the aisle here today in America. And so she had a very different perspective on the way things are gone post 2016. In her view, we've been going backwards.
Wow. And you said she worked at Teen Vogue. Did she have stuff to say about what younger news consumers are looking for in political coverage, and are they getting it?
Absolutely, she did. She had a lot to say. I mean, and bear in mind that Teen Vogue has become a go-to place for political coverage, particularly for younger readers. It's very similar to the Latino story, actually. The turnout for young Americans is abysmal. It's in 2016, it was still below 50%. And that's, when I say young voters, the classification is from 18 to 29. So it's a really major chunk of the population. And less than half are still voting in 2016. There was very strong turnout in 2018, and people are anticipating a big turnout of young voters in 2020, but it's still not a given.
There is this way that the youth vote is often talked about, and it used to be millennials, and now it's Gen Z, and you have these, like, you know, social media, like Snapchat-obsessed young people that don't care about politics, and they're not engaged, and it's above their head, and they're so selfish, and that's why they don't vote. And, you know, if I was in that age range, that type of narrative would turn me off, and I wouldn't feel that these people speak to my needs or interests. And, you know, when you do have outlets that speak to their interests, you notice that they do get engaged. They do become engaged.
And very much like with the Latino vote, and in Sumita's view, that is in no small part because the media does not talk to younger voters about serious political issues that they care about. And there's a sort of patronizing view that young people only want, like, Snapchat. They only want, you know, 10 seconds worth of something. When Teen Vogue has found, if you go into great depth about serious issues that young people care about, they will respond, they will participate, and they will be very active in engaging with those issues.
They tend to be more interested in some of these kind of social and political issues around gun violence or climate change, more kind of policy-oriented issues.
And does that mean they won't be interested in the election?
No, they'll be interested in the election.
That's different.
Yeah, I think they're interested in the election. They're just not interested in the minutiae of, like, Trump's day-to-day. Like, they're not, they don't care what he's tweeting. They already know he's racist.
It's kind of healthy.
I agree. It actually makes me feel quite relieved.
Oh, right. So, you know, in fact, they're not interested in every tweet or every soundbite. They want that kind of deeper coverage. I mean, is that true of news consumers more broadly?
Ah, if only. It has to be said that it remains incredibly difficult to break away from the tight 24-hour news circle that Donald Trump dictates through his morning tweets. You know, he wakes up at 3 a.m., he splurges a stream of 10 tweets, and that just sets the agenda for the rest of the day. Very difficult to get out of that, not least because, I mean, all newsrooms, including The Guardian's in New York, we have access to real-time data. And it shows when you do a story about what he's just said on Twitter, it gets a very, very large readership, almost invariably.
Trump understands what is a kind of news that catches people's interest and that they consume. He has a very acute understanding of what people are going to click on.
One of the observers in America who's been making this point very strongly is Frank Bruni. He's the New York Times columnist. He was speaking to us in a personal capacity, but he's very concerned about how financial pressure on news organizations can be skewing their coverage.
There's a real tension right now in the media, and there's a real challenge, which is, you know, we're not an industry that is swimming in easy revenue by any stretch of the imagination. We are an industry that is competing very fiercely for the eyeballs we need to then have the subscription fees or the advertising rates we need to stay alive. And the truth of the matter is, and this is again where some of the responsibility here and some of the blame here lies with the public, we have learned that if you write a story about the ridiculousness of Donald Trump's latest tweets, whether that story is riveting to his fans, who just kind of want to see what the media is saying about their guy and if the media is beating up on him, or whether that story is riveting to his foes, who cannot marinate enough in their distaste for him, that story gets a whole lot more traffic than an analysis of Elizabeth Warren's Medicare for All plan, right?
Right, absolutely. Now,
that doesn't mean we don't do the analysis. We have to do it. We just have to figure out how we apportion this in a way that keeps us in business, that responsibly keeps a record of what the President of the United States does, but doesn't leave no oxygen left over for this other stuff that is vital to democracy and is really the substantive stuff that makes us all more intelligent voters and gets us to a better result.
In an era where newspapers and TV stations are finding it hard to make revenue through advertising, you know, traffic and readership is incredibly important. It cannot be dismissed. And it may even be the lifeline that allows serious news organizations to go on to do other more probing analytical work and investigative work. So it is a very, very difficult thing to break. And I look around the media landscape in America and I don't see anyone managing to do it. It just simply isn't happening. And perhaps for good reasons, because the things that Trump says in his tweets are outrageous, they're often unconstitutional, they're often racist or sexist. And he is president of the United States, so it's kind of difficult to ignore. But can I raise one other issue?
Of course.
I mean, we talked about financial pressures, which is a real problem, but arguably a kind of bigger cloud hanging over all of us is the way that Trump has turned people against the media, has undermined trust in the media, and he now calls us the enemy of the people, which has led to some news organizations fearing for the physical safety of their reporters. But it also, again, kind of completely skews what we're able to do because, you know, whilst trying to cover what's happening in the election, we're also aware that we're having to try and convince people that what we're doing is not fake news.
I mean, but what about actual fake news? I mean, this is an issue, isn't it? There are disinformation campaigns we've seen on social media, both in the UK and the US.
Yeah. Before we talk about Facebook, let's just underline again that fake news, that is Donald Trump. The Washington Post has done a daily count of his lies and falsehoods since he came into the White House. It's currently above 13,000. So just think about that. Since January 2017, since he became president, Trump has made more than 13,000 falsehoods in his public statements.
Wow.
So just a little bit of context there. But having said that, there's also the issue of Facebook, which, you know, one could write volumes about in itself. But there is a feeling that, look, we're putting so much effort into trying and getting things right in, quote unquote, the mainstream media. We're really trying hard. We may not have fixed anything. And as we've been discussing, there are problems ahead. But at least we're trying. Meanwhile, if Facebook is awash with misinformation, that's only going to go so far.
So at the start of 2020, we have a president who, as you say, openly lies and who attacks the mainstream media relentlessly. A president who's gunning for re-election. It's going to be another challenging year for journalists in America, isn't it?
The way I look at it is like it's like a football match in which one half of the game, one team, plays by the rules that they've played by for the last 20, 30 years. And in America, those rules and media rules are very, very strong. There's a real sense of fairness and accuracy. There's a lot of fact-checking goes on. It's really taken seriously. And those people are still playing by the same old rules. And then they're facing a team which will not listen to the referee, will not accept the rules of the game, and just kick the ball around any way they like. And that's the world that we're dealing with. And I don't think anyone in that media team knows what to do about it. You know, but maybe things are even worse than that. Maybe the confusion and chaos that we've been discussing in the media world is just a small part of it. And Jorge Ramos, the guy who was ejected from Trump from his press conference in 2016, who stood up for media coverage in the face of someone he sees as a bully, he says it maybe goes as far as to threaten democracy in America itself.
I'm very uncomfortable with we are polarized. We're much more polarized than ever before. I got to this country in 1983, and I've never seen the press so polarized as it is today. And this is very dangerous for a democracy. I am very concerned that the truth is disappearing, that facts don't matter anymore, that lies have such an important weight in our political life. And that kind of polarization, it is incredibly difficult. You know, I've covered Latin America for many decades, and I think that has prepared me for what I'm seeing right here in the United States. In other words, to have someone leading the country who's an authoritarian, who's not telling the truth, who's constantly lying, and then the country completely divided on who is for him and who is against him. I'm very, very concerned of the polarization of news and the lack of truth that I see in some of so-called journalistic coverage.
And that's a very strong statement in an election year. Let me finally ask you, Ed, 9 months from now, do you think we'll be having a conversation again about what went wrong in the media?
I fear that we're just at the start of this sort of chasm about where people get the information from and how it emboldens them to do things that may be even anti-democratic. And I fear that maybe our grip on that within the media is kind of sliding, and that we may come out of 2020 feeling, well, we did a better job in 2016, but was it enough?
Ed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Ed Pilkington, chief reporter at Guardian US. Do go to the website to read his report. Coming up, the tactics that could prevent many Americans voting in that presidential election. Now, we've been hearing about Americans going to the polls this year, but when they do, many people will be denied the chance to vote at all. Carol Anderson, a professor of African American Studies, traces the history of a tactic that controls who can exercise their democratic right.
Voter suppression is one of the most insidious, pernicious means to systematically destroy a democracy and its citizens' basic rights. It denies people their right to vote, denies people their right to choose their elected representatives, and denies people their voice. I start with the Mississippi Plan of 1890, and that's where the state of Mississippi, its legislators, looked up and said, how do we stop all of these black people from voting? Then they systematically crafted a series of rules to get around the 15th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution that said that the right to vote shall not be denied on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So what it did was it took the societally imposed conditions on African Americans and used those conditions, like poverty born out of centuries of slavery, or literacy born out of the systematic denial of education, and made those the access points to the ballot box. By 1940, when the U.S. is getting ready to fight Nazis, only 3% of African Americans in the South were registered to vote. That is why you have this massive civil rights movement that leads to that cinematic explosion on the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
This is an unlawful assembly. You are to disperse. You are ordered to disperse. Go home or go to your church. This march will not continue.
But the first order of business on every legislative agenda, let us march on ballot boxes.
That explosion on the Edmund Pettus Bridge would eventually lead to the Voting Rights Act. In 1960, only about 5% of African Americans were registered to vote. After the passage of the Voting Rights Act, almost 60% of African Americans, adults in Mississippi, were registered to vote. The Voting Rights Act worked. It worked so well. It worked too well because it was so effective. You had states that were fighting it. South Carolina fought it. Mississippi fought it. Virginia fought it. You had the Nixon administration fighting it. You had the Reagan administration fighting it. And all of those fights would eventually lead us into the 2013 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Shelby County v. Holder, that gutted the Voting Rights Act. Just 2 hours after that decision, the state of Texas implemented a voter ID law that has been through the courts multiple times because it's racially discriminatory. You had Alabama unleash its voter ID law. Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Kansas. Since 2014, 33 million people have been removed from the voter rolls. This isn't just a Southern phenomenon. These voter suppression laws have metastasized throughout the United States, and at one point they were in over 30 states. We have a political party, the Republicans, who are absolutely afraid of the growing diversity in America's electorate. Their party has moved so far to the right that their policies, their anti-immigrant policies, their anti-reproductive rights policies, their anti-environment policies don't resonate with the broad swath of American people. So instead of revising their policies, you see them crafting laws to figure out how do we shut down African Americans? How do we shut down Latinos? How do we shut down Asian Americans? How do we shut down the young? How do we shut down the poor? They use it by crafting all of this in the language of trying to protect democracy, of trying to stop this so-called massive, rampant voter fraud. But that lie has been exposed over and over, even with Trump's Presidential Election Integrity Commission, where they went hunting for voter fraud and the pages were absolutely empty. You know, I am a scholar of civil and human rights, and I'm a historian. And it has been absolutely frightening to watch the ease with which the United States is descending once again into a space where its people will not have a voice in the government. The price of this democracy is going to be the eternal vigilance of the American people. We have to turn out in numbers like we've never seen before at the polls, because what voter suppression at its fundamental core is a denial of accountability.
That was Carol Anderson, Chair of African American Studies at Emory University and author of One Person, No Vote. That's it for today. My thanks to Ed Pilkington and Carol Anderson. This episode was produced by Mithali Rao and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.